Dean Borg with River to River. Just as I'm going on the air, my voice left me, and I'm sorry about that. I'm Donna Hoffman, chair of the University of Northern Iowa's Political Science Department, is with us, and Kathy Obradovich, Des Moines Register political columnist. And we're going to be talking about the congressional races, particularly the first and the third congressional districts. Let me ask you, Donna and Kathy, hello, Kathy?
Hi, Dean.
And Donna.
Hi, Dean.
Bear with the voice. It'll get better. The Kathy, the first district, had plenty of time for candidates to decide on getting to the race. Bruce Braley jumped into the Senate race as soon as incumbent Tom Harkin announced his retirement more than a year ago. In the third district, though, time was shorter. And has that in any way, Kathy, influenced the primary campaign, particularly as Democrat Stacey Apple planned her campaign?
Yeah, I think it has shaped the campaign in some ways. We have seen, in fact, the candidates, perhaps the field is less well known than, you know, you look at compare it to the Senate race where candidates were jumping in really starting a year ago, over a year ago when Senator Tom Harkin announced his retirement. He did that in early 2013. It was at the end of 2013 when Tom Latham decided not to run again. And so we actually had one candidate shipped over from the Senate race, David Young, and then candidates getting in quick succession. The only candidate who was actually in the primary before Latham announced his retirement was Joe Grandinette of Des Moines, and he is running a very dark horse campaign, not considered to be very competitive.
And what are the polls showing there right now?
Well, I have to tell you, there hasn't been a whole lot of polling, Dean, and that is typical of congressional races. The one poll that I saw recently showed Brad Zahn, state senator from Urbandale, who has actually won the nomination on the Republican side before. He was the nominee in 2010.
Yes.
And he actually has 17%. Everybody else was in single digits. However, you know, you've got one poll. It's not all that reliable. And it really, other than Grandinette, Zahn actually has the least money of anybody in the race.
But as far as name recognition in looking at that, Brad Zahn, of course, is in the Iowa legislature. But there's Matt Schultz down in the poll that you're citing, I think, is the Loras College poll.
Right.
And he's 10 percentage points behind Brad Zahn down in fourth place.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Matt Schultz, in the middle of the pack in fundraising, he had started off planning to run for re-election as Secretary of State, was facing a pretty stiff challenge from Democrat Brad Anderson, who had run Barack Obama's Iowa caucus campaign, so a seasoned campaigner. When he switched over to the third district race, news came out critical of the way he had managed his office, and in particular, paying staffers who had been laid off, keeping them on the payroll while they continued to work or maybe not work from home. So I think that has hurt Matt Schultz, even though I would argue that he's as well known or maybe better known outside of Polk County than Brad Zahn. I tell you what, when I talk to Republicans about their predictions for that district, I never hear Matt Schultz's name.
Donna Hoffman, what are your observations? You've heard Kathy analyze briefly the third district, but what are you adding to that, what she said?
Well, one of the things that's interesting in the poll that Kathy cited, the Loras College poll, is that there's still 50% in that poll that are undecided. And, you know, the primary is June 3rd. That's not very far away. This particular poll was done in mid-May.
Yep.
And that is a lot of people who are sitting back and still watching
what's taking
place. Well, I think some of it is the uncertainty. Again, Kathy mentioned, you know, Tom Latham got out a little bit later than people didn't expect him to come out. And then he does come out. And Republicans had not been preparing for that kind of a entry into that race because they assumed he was going to still run.
So what you're saying is
that they were a little flat-footed, I think, caught a little bit flat-footed. And then you have the Schultz issue, which I think without his scandal, he would have been he might be a little higher. You have Zahn, I think, being at the top of that, although still 17% is, you know, not very good.
You know, I can understand what you're saying, Donna, as far as candidates not being ready to get into the race. But people know, that is, you're saying that so many are undecided now because they didn't expect that Tom Latham was going to be leaving that seat.
Well, that's not exactly what I'm saying. I'm just saying that, you know, there was some uncertainty there. And then with the Schultz dynamic that you have with the issue in the Secretary of State's office, he's been controversial a bit even before that in terms of voter ID and pushing that, which certainly with Republican primary voters is something that has been fairly popular. But there's some uncertainty there. I think that the voters are just sitting back and watching to see what else will develop in that particular race. The candidates beyond Zahn and Schultz are not really well known, but you have somebody like David Young in the race, who is a former staffer to Senator Grassley.
Yes.
Has, you know, some establishment credibility within the Republican Party. So I think voters are being very hesitant in that particular district. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pretty interesting that you have that many people at this point still undecided.
What would you say about how is that going to influence the number of people who turn out or have already voted absentee?
Well, you know, typically Republicans do not vote in the same numbers as Democrats do in terms of absentee and early voting. And so if you look at numbers, the Democrats are across the state are usually doing better in that. And that's particularly true in the first district. But, you know, so Republicans do tend to more than Democrats vote on Election Day. They're not as into the early voting and the absentee voting. And so, again, they're sitting back. They're watching what's happening. And, you know, another factor that we could talk about here is also that you have a competitive race on the GOP side at the state Senate level as well. And so there's things that are developing there. There's a multi-candidate crowd there as well. And so you may have Republicans at this point still just waiting to see a little bit closer to Election Day what will develop before they'll tell a pollster exactly what they're going to do.
So what, Kathy, is likely to happen when this race goes to convention and is decided by Republican activists? That's assuming that no one gets 35%.
Right. Typically, the conventional wisdom is that if a race goes to convention, that the handicap, the safe bet is with the most conservative candidate. Hmm. In this race, I would argue that that Robert Kramer is got a good chance at the title of being most conservative in the sense that he is on the board of the Family Leader, which is Bob Vanderplaats's organization. He has been endorsed by Mike Huckabee, who won the caucuses in 2008. And he has made news in the past because of his social agenda. Mm-hmm. The Senate Democrats in the Iowa legislature turned down his nomination by Terry Branstad for the State Board of Regents, mainly because he's been an activist on social issues, Republican conservative social issues. So, you know, conventional wisdom would say he would be perhaps have an inside track at the convention. However, I was at the 3rd District Convention last month, and I saw a lot of Branstad establishment types wearing Monty Shaw stickers. Now, you may recall, and I think we've talked about this, how Branstad made a point of really trying to organize the caucuses in January and pack his supporters into those conventions. So it's possible that conventional wisdom is not necessarily going to apply to conventions,
because the makeup of the delegates has changed.
Exactly.
Yep. You heard Donna talking. I think it was Donna who said the Senate primary might be impacting or affecting the primary. What do you think about that?
I think it will certainly affect turnout. I think that we will see a lot greater turnout. Mm-hmm. If you look in the 3rd District, for example, where we've got an open congressional seat and the Senate seat, we'll probably see pretty healthy turnout for the Republican primary. You know, it may be less so in some of the other districts where there's not as much of a primary race, although there are contested primaries for the Republicans in the 1st District and the 2nd District, as well as the 3rd. So I would say that the Senate race is probably going to be what drives the turnout. Mm-hmm. Candidates are just higher profile. They've spent more money. People around the state are seeing those TV ads.
We've got a packed show here this morning because we have a number of audio cuts from these candidates, and we're going to let them speak for themselves and then have you analyze, if you will, Donna and Kathy, what they're saying. But I also want to hear, as we can squeeze them in, from listeners. And the question I would ask, if you'll dial 866-780-9100 or contact us by social media on Facebook, put your question in there. But what do you want to hear from the candidates? And what are you not hearing that will help you decide for whom to vote? And the number again is 866-780-9100. And we'll try to squeeze your calls in as we go along here this noon. And getting to some of those cuts, the Obama administration, this is on the renewable fuel standard, the RFS, seems to be sending some signals that the number of gallons of U.S. gasoline required to be blended into normal gasoline under the 2014 renewable fuel standard will be decreasing. And some think by as much as a little over nearly 1.5 or 1.5 billion gallons. Actually, it'd be about 1.3 is the estimate. Now, this would affect ethanol producers. Iowa is a big producer of ethanol, and corn farmers who sell corn to the ethanol plants. So we asked the Republican candidates in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District what their solutions were for finding new energy ideas that would still benefit Iowa but would have more of a national appeal. Well, as you might expect, all the candidates supported keeping the renewable fuel standard right where it is right now, because Iowa benefits a lot from that, including this comment from State Senator Brad Zaughan.
Renewable fuels are good for the state of Iowa. I can tell you that what I will do in Washington, D.C. is fight for the renewable fuels industry here in the state of Iowa and make sure that we are treated equally than some of the petroleum companies that are out there.
Now, here's a comment from businessman Robert Kramer. He says he thinks the government should get out of the job of favoring one industry over another, and he would support ending subsidies for all fuel producers.
And I think we need to get all of these energy sources, you know, kind of weaned off the government and free of subsidies. That's the long-term goal. But I do support keeping the renewable fuel standard mandate for now to make sure that ethanol has a way of getting to the marketplace and that the oil industry can't just squeeze it out. So I think we found a good balance for now, and then the long-term plan is to get everybody free from government help.
Now, here's a comment from candidate, as you have already identified, Mati Shaw, who is the executive director right now of the Renewable Fuels Association here in Iowa. And he says his knowledge of the industry would make him a refreshing voice in the U.S. House Republican Caucus, which he says is now dominated by representatives of oil and gas producing states.
A lot of people think that, you know, that only renewables get federal support. And so I would be very happy to sit down with staff and members and explain to them everything that the oil industry continues to get, from tax credits that date back over 100 years to a federal petroleum mandate to petroleum pipeline loan guarantees to specialized tax structures that only they get. I mean, the playing field is actually tilted very heavily in the favor of oil. We would love a level playing field for renewables because, you know, today ethanol is the world's cheapest source of fuel octane. We would do just fine if there was actually a level playing field.
And here's a comment that we received from, as we have formally identified him here, David Young, who is a former aide to Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. Here's what he says: changing the RFS, renewable fuel standard, should be a matter up for debate and not decided by a federal agency, the EPA.
By having the EPA do this alone, that is not a bipartisan way to do this. That's the administration taking this up all on their own through rules and regulations and maybe even executive orders. This debate needs to happen in Congress, where both sides of the aisle can sit down, have the hearings, have the floor debate, and go about this in a methodical way so that they are representing their constituents.
So, Donna Hoffman, based on those answers, I hope that you were taking a little note there, at least mental note. Who do you think has the best command or is communicating to voters the best command of this issue in terms of how they, if elected, could realistically influence this issue in Washington, D.C.?
Well, you know, they each say basically the same thing. They give support to these fuel standards that the EPA is threatening to adjust down. And it's just that when the original law was passed and then it was updated a couple of years after that, there were targets set for each year. And what the EPA is proposing to do is decrease those targets for the coming year. And they propose what they would do that to, and that will be set by the end of June, as I understand it. So they're all saying, yes, we want to support this, but then they're having variations in terms of maybe ideally what they would support. So we hear, you know, Cramer saying, well, ideally, you know, we just have the free market. The government wouldn't even be involved. You know, you have Zahn saying, you know, I want to be on an even playing field with big oil. You have Shaw also saying something about, you know, level the playing field. You have David Young being taking a little tweak on that and saying, you know, the proper place for this to be determined is in the halls of Congress, not in the EPA. And that gets a little technical. It gets a little wonky in some ways. And I think that's kind of the mode that he kind of fits in terms of the candidates in this race, because he's making this argument. And this is a theme that Republicans have made against President Obama and his administration, you know, for multiple months, is that rather than by administrative fiat, this should be done in Congress. But Congress moves slowly. Congress right now isn't moving much of anything at all. But that's the argument that he's making. And Shaw is adding in that also with his argument that, you know, he's the best suited to bring that issue to Congress. So he gets in that issue with this is the proper place for this is in Congress as well. So they're really not that far apart, but they do have different nuances in terms of how they talk about this. And this is an issue that can get very complicated. Mm-hmm. And sometimes voters really kind of want to hear something that's really relatively black and white, kind of easy to understand. And sometimes they don't do so well with nuance.
Kathy, do you think there's enough of a nuance to differentiate any of those candidates?
Maybe not so much on this issue. And as Donna said, it is very subtle. There is cognitive dissonance among Republicans when they start talking about the RFS, because I think that the baseline position is, in fact, we want the free market. We want to get the government out of these decisions. We don't like subsidies. However, this is a situation where their Iowa pride rears up, and but this is good for Iowa. This is about jobs in Iowa. It is about better prices for corn farmers in Iowa. And so therefore, this rule that normally we wouldn't like if it didn't apply to Iowa, we're going to support in part just because of home state pride and home state interest. And I thought Zahn was probably the most upfront about that, you know, that he says, you know, look, this is Iowa, this is jobs, and we're going to support that. I thought that Young had a fairly clever way to go about it, although wonky, as you say, where he says, well, this shouldn't be with the EPA, this bureaucratic agency, which most of them want to abolish anyway. But to say this should go to Congress, where the way things are now, nothing would happen, so the rule would stay the same. So, I mean, that may be a backdoor way of saying he supports the RFS the way it is, but by also saying, by the way, we all hate the EPA.
Yeah, that's right. And the EPA is a popular target for Republicans right now, Donna.
Right. And it's not just the EPA, but it's Obama's EPA in particular.
Yeah. But Congress does have the power to affect energy policy. But really, if you roll that question into what can one member of Congress really do to change the EPA. So what I'm really saying is, are voters really saying, are thinking, we'll send you and you'll get some changes done? Or do they know that a freshman member of Congress isn't going to get much done?
Well, you know, you always hear members of Congress, whether they're Democrat or people who want to be members of Congress, whether they're Democrats or whether they're Republicans, saying, I'm one of you, send me to Congress, I'll change the way things are done. And you know, political scientists, we know that as a freshman, you're not going to get anything done. And you might get on, you might, maybe, if you're a dragon slayer, meaning that you've brought down a big incumbent, you might get on a committee that you prefer. But mm-hmm. you're a low man on the totem pole in that regard, and you're not going to get a whole lot done. But, you know, this is an issue that is out there brewing, and it does. This is an issue in which you can have Democrats and Republicans being on the same page, again, depending on what state they're from and what their state interests are. So Republicans in big oil states who aren't ethanol producing states or aren't corn producing states are going to be a little bit different in terms of this. And so there is that interesting dynamic with this particular issue that you could potentially see in Congress, you know, some at least debate. But let's make the point, though, that when Congress originally passed this standard, they did leave it to the EPA to set that, and that's what regulatory entities like the EPA do. And it is, you know, making policy, but that's what bureaucratic entities do. And the public oftentimes thinks that's a little bit unsavory because they're bureaucrats, they're not elected. But nevertheless, that is one of the ways that policy gets made through bureaucracy.
Another aspect of this, Kathy, is that Iowa losing congressional seats over the years also is losing clout on issues like this.
Exactly, Dean. Tom Latham was the most senior member of Iowa's House delegation. We also have retirement of Tom Harkin, who, while not Iowa's senior senator, is senior to most senators in the U.S. Senate. So Iowa is losing some of that, clout through seniority, a significant amount of clout through seniority in its delegation. The other thing, too, when you refer to this particular issue, is that renewable energy, while it does have plenty of advocates around the country, they have nowhere near the kind of money that they can bring to bear on influencing candidates and races. And so, when you look at the lay of the land in Congress and what one legislator can do, you're looking at not just individual legislators, but also the lobby and the special interests lined up behind them.
And Donna, though, building on what has just been said by you and Kathy, it's an issue that is important to Iowa, but is it one that resonates with people going to vote in primary elections?
Well, it does somewhat in Iowa, and certainly people in the state of Iowa understand that this is an issue that cuts across agricultural issues, that cuts across renewable energy issues. But it's not a bread and butter issue for a lot of voters in the state, and sometimes those make a bigger difference.
Now, to our listeners and to everyone, if you'd like to hear more of what these candidates had to say about a variety of issues, check out the 2014 Voter Guide at iowapublicradio.org. I'll talk more about that later. And right now, we're going to break for a newscast, and we'll be back talking about the first congressional district after we finish the news. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. Dean Borg continuing River to River now on Iowa Public Radio. And before we broke for the newscast or Dennis Reese, I was talking about the voter guide on Iowa Public Radio's website, and I'd like to bring that back into our conversation now. We currently have profiles available for 11 of the 19 candidates involved in primaries in Iowa's open congressional races. And by later today, we hope to have 16 profiles there. So if you don't see what you want right now about a candidate, check back to iowapublicradio.org, and we should have it there for you. Catherine Perkins has led the development of that voter profile on Iowa Public Radio's website. I looked at it for the first time this morning because it's just now being assembled, and I really found it very, very helpful. I think it's the most comprehensive guide that I've seen, and you'll see transcripts there of interviews that we've done with the candidates. So iowapublicradio.org, Catherine has led that and assisted by many people on our news staff, and I think it's just excellent. I recommend it highly to you. We're talking with Donna Hoffman, chair of the University of Northern Iowa's Political Science Department, and Kathy Obradovich, a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. We've been talking about the third congressional district, and that seat being vacated now by Republican Tom Latham. We're going to move now over into Iowa's first congressional district, just the reverse from the third district, in that the greater number of candidates here is in the Democratic primary. Donna Hoffman, is that because it's now a Democratic district represented by Bruce Braley, or are there other factors that influence more Democrats going after that open seat, trying to hold it in the Democratic column?
Well, there's a primary on both sides, and that's, you know, yes, oftentimes what open seats do. And in particular, as we talked about in the first part of the hour, this open seat, we knew it was going to be open relatively early. So certainly, you know, Democrats in this part of the state looked at that race as an open seat, and many of them got in. It's, you know, it's open seats don't happen very often. And if you want to try to make that leap, especially, you know, we have three state legislators in the Democratic primary. If you want to make that leap to the U.S. Congress, an open seat is your best advantage to do that. And this district, you know, has elected Bruce Braley, although narrowly. And, you know, let's not forget, in 2010, he almost lost his seat to Ben Lang. That kind of came out of the blue. This really is a very interesting district in terms of, you know, how it's made up, because the plurality of voters, active voters in the state in District 1, are no party. And we have closed primaries in Iowa, so you need to be a Democrat or Republican to participate. That's not saying the no party folks on June 3rd could not come to the polls and declare they're a Democrat or Republican and participate in those events. They certainly could, but they're unlikely. Most of them are very unlikely to do that. So the, you know, it will be a competitive race when it comes down to the general election, but certainly we first have to get through the primary for that. And it's certainly a race on the Democratic side.
That's right. And is it a nice race, or is it getting a little rough?
You know, so far it's not too bad. But, you know, there's still a little bit of time for that to get a little bare knuckles, I suppose. But you do have, you know, an interesting mix of candidates. You have Pat Murphy, who's, you know, a former speaker of the Iowa State House.
Yeah.
You have Inessa Kotozovich, who was the youngest person elected to the state legislature at one point. You have Dave O'Brien, who's from Cedar Rapids area, yep, civil rights attorney. You have Monica Vernon, also from Cedar Rapids. You have Swati Dandekar, also from Cedar Rapids, and she was in, yep, the state legislature as well.
Yep.
And so there's a really interesting mix here, and three women in the race. Iowa, of course, has never elected a woman to Congress, and that has been a feature in some of the things that the candidates have said as well.
Well, and Kathy, do you think that that nomination turns on the possibility of electing a woman to Congress from
Iowa?
Actually,
I think it probably doesn't turn on that. I think, first of all, you've got a situation where there's a couple of really interesting dynamics in the Democratic field. First,
yes,
of all, the top money raisers are probably not considered the front runners in this primary. Monica Vernon is actually the top fundraiser, and Swati Dandekar, both of them have been able to do some significant self-funding as well as healthy fundraising. Pat Murphy, state representative from Dubuque, is probably considered the front runner. He is the best known in the district all along, has been considered a likely leader for the nomination. A lot of times when I talk to Democrats, they say that the real suspense there is whether Murphy wins it outright or if it has to go to convention.
And is labor a major component of Murphy's support?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Labor has, and, you know, Pat Murphy has spent years not only courting labor, but also really getting to know the people who are really active in the parties all through that district. He's been thinking about running for the seat for a long time. This is his first opportunity to have an open seat. And so, you know, I think that Democrats around the state who are watching this race will be pretty surprised if he doesn't win that primary.
No, but geographically, too, there's an interesting mix here. Pat Murphy is in Dubuque. I mean, he's a resident of Dubuque, but as you say, has represented, he's been in the State House of Representatives, but has labor interests in heavily unionized Waterloo, strong labor unions in Cedar Rapids. And you've mentioned Monica Vernon being a top money raiser. She's on the Cedar Rapids City Council right now. Swati Dandekar, also from the Cedar Rapids area, and she has served in the legislature and on the Iowa Utilities Board. But it's interesting that you've got two Cedar Rapids women and Pat Murphy in Dubuque, Inessa Kotozovich in Waterloo. So you've got all three major cities in that district represented, and yet you say Pat Murphy is leading.
Yeah, well, first of all, you've got the potential for three candidates to divide up that vote in Cedar Rapids, which, you know, that at Linn County there is the biggest population center in the district, but you've got three candidates located there who may be dividing up that vote. And Anessa, while a charming young lady and has been very I think she's kept herself in the race with fundraising. She hasn't raised as much money as any of the top three. We can have Democrats say, well, you know, she's very young. She'll have another opportunity to run. And so you end up hearing that kind of discussion when you talk about the race. Dave O'Brien, well-liked, active in Democratic Party politics, and I think that he, you know, could be a contender in this race. I'd be surprised if he wasn't somewhere in the top three, but you don't hear a lot of buzz about him either.
And Donna, did you say that this is one, or was it Kathy? I can't remember who said it, but that this could be won outright by one of the candidates. You wouldn't be surprised if this did not go to convention.
Actually, Kathy said that, but I think it's kind of I'll hide in the corner and watch on this one, because with the Loras College poll that we talked about earlier, Murphy is getting close to that 35% mark that you need to avoid the convention. And so you could see him win it outright, I think. If it goes to convention, I still think he is favored there. However, you know, you need to think about all five of these candidates have been in this race. They've been in it for, you know, quite some time, and they all have a convention strategy, and they've all been working on that convention strategy, because in this crowded a field and with this kind of race, they would be crazy not to. And, you know, again, I still think that Murphy has the edge there just because of the time that he served in the State House, sure, the support that he has from labor, the fact that he was Speaker as well. But nevertheless, I think it'll be an interesting dynamic to see what happens with that particular race.
Well, let's talk about one of the issues. And across the Republican primaries, we're seeing Obamacare being front and center. So Democrats distancing themselves, some of them, from the Obama administration, and more specifically from President Obama's Affordable Care Act. And there's an interesting exception in the first district Democratic primary. Attorney, as you mentioned, Dave O'Brien from Cedar Rapids, was asked if he would consider revisions to the program, and he said he would instead fully implement it.
Anytime you start a big new program like this, there are going to be potholes that we have to overcome. But as long as we keep talking about revising the Affordable Care Act, the Republicans are going to think of that as a euphemism for destroying it, and that's not acceptable to me. Every Iowan, every American deserves the right to health care. And as Democrats, we're going to make sure that happens. I don't want to talk about revising Obamacare. I want to talk about implementing it. And when we get a few years down the line, why, we'll make some necessary tweaks in order to broaden the program and make it more effective.
We mentioned Pat Murphy. He is acknowledged by the two of you to maybe be the front runner there, maybe win it outright. But when asked to give an example of an area where he might be willing to compromise with the other party, Pat Murphy offered Obamacare as an example.
As long as we keep the current program intact and we guarantee people, the current 8 million Americans, have access to health insurance, and we expand those programs, I'll be willing to work with Republicans to tweak the law, maybe change the taxes on it, or increase the ability for people to have access to health insurance without drastically changing the program. I think that's an area where even some Republicans are starting to admit that that's a possibility.
Now, let's go to the Republican comment here. The reality of the difficulty of repealing Obamacare is a message that at least some Republicans are conceding. They're saying that it'd be difficult, despite using repeal as a campaign refrain. And that includes businessman Steve Rathje, Cedar Rapids, who's in a three-way primary for the GOP nomination in that first congressional district.
It's there. Some of us are going to have to deal with it until we have the numbers to repeal it. But until then, I think if we take every single part and we look for free market solutions, as is in my plan, it's one of the stages of my plan, the free market solutions, which allow us, for example, and you've heard it time and time again, let's allow the people to go where they want. to get their health insurance. If I want to go over to Maine, if that's where it's the least expensive for me and my family to get it, or somewhere else, then let me go do that.
No, this isn't Democrat against Republican in this election. This is Republicans against Republicans and Democrats against Democrats to see who gets the nomination. But Kathy, who do you think is going to find the most success in this appeal to primary voters? The Democrat, loyal to the president's centerpiece legislation and his legacy? The Democrat who's willing to compromise on some pieces of that legislation? Or the Republican who says we should scrap it, if at all possible, and revise wherever possible?
Well, Dean, I think that we see Dave O'Brien with his, let's be loyal to Obamacare, really trying to appeal to the bedrock of his party. I think that what we're seeing with the other candidates is an acknowledgement that, A, Obamacare is unpopular with Iowa voters. Poll after poll shows Obamacare has problems with Iowa voters. But secondly, those same voters like a lot of the things that Obamacare does. They like the guaranteed coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. They like the fact that 26-year-olds young people can stay on their parents' insurance. They like a lot of those things that are part of the Obamacare. So the idea of repealing it is not necessarily, first of all, it doesn't seem realistic to voters, and secondly, is not necessarily what they want, at least not with some fairly detailed and viable alternatives. And the candidates tend to talk a lot about free market solutions without really fully explaining how those would work.
Donna, I'm interested in your take on that, on the appeal to primary voters of what you just heard.
Well, I think, O'Brien certainly is giving that full-throated support of that, because his perception is of Democratic primary voters is that's where he's going to position himself. That's where he thinks he wants to be to get the most votes. You do have a range within these candidates, and it's not unique just to this race either. Across the country, you have Democrats, depending on where they are from and what the dynamics of their own particular situation is, giving various emphases to what they say about Obamacare and whether they give it full-throated support or whether they equivocate on it somewhat. So, you certainly have, I think, Pat Murphy looking to a general election campaign where he might be the nominee, where he might have to defend what he said in a primary campaign, and he's giving himself enough wiggle room there. I mean, certainly, I think everybody can agree the rollout of Obamacare was not particularly stellar. And so using that language that many Democrats across the country, not just in the first district, are using keep it but tweak it, kind of notion, you see him talking about and some of the other candidates in that Democratic primary as well.
Kathy, you covered, I think, going over to the Senate candidates now. And really what I'm asking is this something that's really resonating among likely primary voters? And the Senate candidates, the Republican side, just had an entire debate on health care legislation. Did your eyes glaze over?
Actually, I thought it was fascinating, but that's just the wonky little kind of person I am. I really liked the fact that these Republican candidates, who are, their baseline positions are really pretty similar to each other, which is either repeal or significantly change Obamacare. We got to hear a little bit more about what exactly they're thinking they would do instead. And so some of the things, like one of the arguments we hear a lot is make the insurance market more competitive by selling insurance across state lines. And the candidates had a whole debate on what that would mean. And there were some differences. Mark Jacobs, for example, said, Iowa does a good job with its insurance. Why would we want to have other companies come in here and possibly threaten the insurers that we have and the regulatory structure that we have here in Iowa? The others said, no, what we need is for Iowa and other states around the nation to lower those regulatory barriers and essentially allow a lot more free market activity in the insurance. So that was fascinating. And I do think that it's something that people are paying attention to. People in Iowa are significantly, people have insurance in Iowa. And so what they want to know in part is how Obamacare is going to affect their own insurance and what is going to happen with the prices. And so I think that people are going to want to hear that from candidates.
Donna, what do you think will actually happen now with regards to Obamacare after the midterm elections in November? Will Republicans get a veto-proof majority that would allow for a repeal? You see, you know, you can pass legislation in the Congress, but, you know, the president is not going to budge an inch on his legacy with Obamacare. So it would have to have a veto-proof majority there. Will they get enough seats, do you think, to put enough political pressure on the president to get him to review the law or revise it in some way?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you have the Senate potentially going to the Republicans. It's currently in Democratic hands. But, you know, no forecast that I've seen is saying that the Republicans would be able to have a veto-proof majority there. And so it is something that in terms of reality, I mean, this is one of the things that Democrats and Republicans have brought up. Democrats want to paint Republicans as being unrealistic. You know, look, Obama's in office until January of 17. This is his signature domestic accomplishment. He's not going to, you know, repeal it. You want to repeal it. You've taken 40-some votes already in Congress to do so, but it's in the House, but it's not going anywhere in the Senate. So there, you know, Republicans are making an argument we could change the Senate, but Obama's still going to be there. This is a midterm election. He's not on the ballot. And so I think, your initial question, what happens after the election, it depends on what the outcome of the election is, and it depends on whether the policymakers think this was an election that was fought and won, whoever wins it, on Obamacare or not. And there are a lot of other issues out there, and certainly Democrats, you know, while Republicans do kind of want to make this their centerpiece in terms of their issue, Democrats, you know, are not. There are other issues that they're stressing, minimum wage, women's issues, and they're, you know, to get their voters to turn out in particular. And so I think what happens depends on, you know, what we read from the election results after November.
Kathy, let's go to the Republican side here right now. And I'm struck. I'd like to have you geographically trace that first district, because you've got Rod Blum in Dubuque, Gail Bolivar, Marshalltown, Steve Rathje, Cedar Rapids, and you can trace for us now what all that means.
Well, Dean, first of all, it sort of underscores just how huge this district is. There's a lot of geography here, and I think though that geography matters less perhaps than some other factors in this race. Rod Blum has run before. I think that's a significant advantage to him, even though he lost a primary to Ben Lang, who ultimately lost to Bruce Braley. I think that experience has helped him organize. He has some Liberty candidate backing, supporters of the Ron Paul presidential campaign are behind him, and I think that has helped bolster his fundraising. And he has started to pull away, I think, in some of the polls, very few polls that have been done up there.
And Steve Rathje has been in the race before. I remember him running for the nomination a couple of years ago.
Yes, and he has not gained traction in the past either. He is competitive in fundraising in this race, however, and so, you know, I think that in a low turnout election, which this could possibly be on the Republican side, a lot of things could happen. Gail Bolivar has positioned himself as sort of the moderate in the race, and being from Marshalltown and also I think that the ideological positioning makes him probably less competitive as a candidate. Also, if you look at the fundraising, he's pretty far below the other two candidates.
Mm-hmm. Donna, your observations on the geographical spread there and who's running as far as your prognostications on who's running ahead in the polls?
Well, of course, you know, Blum has come in that Loris poll a little bit ahead, actually about double of what Rathje was polling. But again, you know, it's got a high margin of error. But nevertheless, you know, what struck me about Rathje is I'm not sure his heart's in it. I mean, the previous time he ran, he did get out of the race. And if you look at his fundraising, it is fairly competitive at one level. But he hasn't put any of his own money into the race, and I find that kind of interesting. It could mean that he's going to put some in right at the last minute. It could mean that he's not. And I just haven't seen I've seen a little bit more of Blum and Blum signs around in particular than I have from Rathje.
Well, we've got less than a week, and a week from today we'll be talking about what happened. Thank you very much. Donna Hoffman, University of Northern Iowa, Kathy Obradovich, Des Moines Register political columnist. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon, executive producer Catherine Perkins, production assistants today from Dennis Reese, John Pemble, and Tony Daner. I'm Dean Borg. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.